Hello and welcome to the NSF SCI's Distinguished Lecture Series. Today, we're very thrilled to present a talk by Yijin Choi from University of Washington. Yijin is arguably the world's leading researcher in common sense reasoning for natural language processing. She holds the Brett Hessel Chair as Associate Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at that university. Simultaneously, she's a senior research manager at AI2, the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence, overseeing the Mosaic Project. She's won an incredible range of awards since earning her PhD at Cornell under Claire Cardi in 2010. In 2013, she was part of a team that received the ICZV MAR Prize, the biggest annual award in computer vision, for their paper on large-scale image categorization to entry-level categories. She was named to IEEE's AI Top 10 to Watch list in 2015. And in 2017, she led a team that won the Alexa Prize Challenge. The system could keep up an interesting conversation for, on average, 10 minutes and 22 seconds. But here we'll challenge Yijin to stay interesting for a full hour. Finally, she won the Anita Borg Early Career Award in 2018. And with that, just a housekeeping. So Yijin will talk for about an hour. We then will have a question and answers. I'll be moderating those, and you'll be using the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. So be sure to click on the Q&A, not the chat button, because I'll look at the Q&A and be picking from your typed questions and then reading them to Yijin. So with that, let's get started. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me here today. Very excited to share our recent adventures in common sense and in tuning. So I was asked to share my journey to where I am today, which is a little bit of a long story, but I'm going to get back to it later in the talk. So for now, let me complain a little bit about the current paradigm of deep learning to achieve human level or superhuman level performances on a variety of leaderboards. So a lot of it is based on, or almost all of it is based on supervised learning on a lot of multiple choice questions. It's often built on top of self-supervised models or pre-trained models that is fed with a lot of raw data. And this is the winning recipe right now for almost all leaderboards. But the problem is that these models are actually brittle if provided with either at the domain examples. So it looks as if right now we know how to solve a data set without really solving the underlying task. This is a big concern, and people started talking about how we might get out of it, which motivates research on multitask learning and transfer learning and so forth. But let's talk about a bigger question between what's the fundamental difference between the way that humans understand the world and the way that machines learn data specific patterns in their neural representations. So when we think about this, people oftentimes talk about system one and system two reasoning, which became popularized by this thinking fast and slow due to Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winner. Which is great, except that it seems that as a result, there's now a bit floating around in the community that we maybe know how to do system one reasoning with the deep learning. We've taken care of it, and we now only need to figure out system two reasoning. So I don't think that that's quite true, because in fact, in Kahneman's earlier work, he talked about three cognitive systems that include perception in addition to system one and system two reasonings. So in fact, both the perception and intuition, or system one reasoning, are together what corresponds to this fast, automatic, effortless, associative reasoning. And then system two reasoning is the one that's slow and effortful. What's interesting about the content layer on the bottom is that both system one and system two require conceptual representations, being able to reason about past, present, and future. And they both involve natural language. So in terms of a particular applications, when people think about system two reasoning, they often think about solving puzzles, writing programs, and proving logic theorems. But of course, even reviewing ACL papers or crafting ACL rebuttals or giving an invited talk would require system two reasoning as well. In terms of perception, so this is where deep learning performs really well. For example, object recognition, image segmentation, speech recognition, and also in fact machine translation, which in some sense, I mean, the ability to translate one language to another may seem a little bit at a higher level cognitive function, but the way that neural network works today is a little bit more into this perceptual style formulation of the problem. And this works really well right now. Intuition is the one in the middle, which has received less amount of research attention in the field, which corresponds to reasoning about preconditions and postconditions, and reasoning about what happens before and after, reasoning about people's motivations and intents, their mental and emotional states. So this is what humans do subconsciously and every waking minute of our life, whereas system two reasoning is the one that we could spend hours or even days not invoking that sort of cognitive function. So this talk is going to be focusing really on intuitive reasoning. And to make my point a little bit clearer, let me use a concrete example known as Roger Shepard's Monsters in a Tunnel. So what do you see in this image? It's not just the two monsters in a tunnel. You see a story that two monsters, as opposed to standing still on one foot, one is chasing another, as opposed to trying to copy his body movements. The chaser has hostile intentions, and the chased is afraid, even though two faces are identical. So, interesting observation here is that none of these inferences is absolutely true, in that any of these have this stochastic characteristics in nature, and everything can be defeasible with additional context. In fact, for example, when you make this inference that, oh, these two monsters seem like running, there's really no sound reason to arrive at that conclusion, but we tend to assume that's likely to be true compared to another possibility that maybe they're standing still on one foot. So a great deal of intuitive inferences, consensus inferences, and a great deal of which can be best described in natural language, not just the words, not graphs of words, but really the complexity and the richness of intuitive inferences to require the full scope of natural language. So TLDR so far is that language might be really critical for the purpose of intuitive inferences. And in doing so, we really need the full scope of language. So in this Roger Shepard's Monsters in a Tunnel example, we really needed to be able to think in natural language. Certainly we are not doing it in a discriminative setting where you might predefine, I don't know, a million different sentences that might describe the situation, score all of them one by one, and then rank all of them. That's really inefficient, and a million sentences are large enough to cover everything. But what's fascinating is that the space of language might be infinite, but certainly when you think about what's going on here, you're without enumerating all possible sentences in the world, you're able to generate a potential explanation token by token, word by word on the fly. That's really fascinating capabilities of human reasoning through language generation. And that is going to be the recurring theme in this talk, reasoning through generation, especially for common sense reasoning and intuitive reasoning. And because this talk is going to pitch potentially different idea that's not necessarily the most trendy one in the field, I felt that it's important to present multiple case studies to back up. So the first part is going to be about unbiased inference time algorithms, which has this flavor of how to make better lemonades out of off-the-shelf neural language models, implying that neural language models do have a lot of weaknesses, but it may be possible to really extract better capabilities, better reasoning capabilities through algorithms. And then the second part will be about supervised, but through declarative knowledge. So let me start with this first work about how we can do counterfactual and abductive common sense reasoning. So let me first define the task. Abductive reasoning is a reasoning problem where, given past observation, for example, Ray hung a tire on a rope to make his daughter a swing, and then a future observation, for example, Ray ran to his daughter to make sure she was okay. As a human, we can reason what might have happened in between. So this is almost like what detectives do, but that's what humans do as well. Pretty much all the time, we are able to hypothesize possible explanations to this partial observation. So the notion of abductive reasoning was first emphasized by philosopher Peirce in 1960. And this is really a task to reason about or generating the best explanation to partial observation, which is quite different from induction and deduction, where we tend to drive information that's provided in the premise in the first place. So abduction generally requires being able to come up with new information that's not exactly in the premise, but something extra. So counterfactual reasoning, on the other hand, requires a different sort of reasoning. And here's an example that I'm going to use from the recent time travel data set that involves five line common sense stories. So for example, Zach was throwing a party. It was a Halloween party, so might dress like a vampire or wizard, but decided to be a skeleton in the end. So what if we change the second sentence a little bit so that it's not any Halloween party, now it's a Game of Thrones party. In which case, we probably need to update the future sentences a bit so that it's really more about the TV show Game of Thrones. So now the particular characters such as Lannister or Stark are being considered. So this is an actual model put from our answer to describe in a bit. But let me first point out what's the relation between this abductive reasoning and counterfactual reasoning. The structure of problems might seem a bit different, but there's one commonality. First of all, they're both non-monotonic reasoning, which involves reasoning about the middle sentence Y given the left context X or past context X, and then future context or right context Z. So they both have this nature. And so the question is, what might pre-trained language models might be able to do? So usually for text generation, people often use GPT-2 or left to right language models because other pre-trained neural language models that are not left to right are not flexible enough to generate sentence length or anything beyond for generation. So this is what we could do off the shelf. But the problem is we can only incorporate past context in this case. So whatever we try to generate might not work well with the future context, of course. So what people these days do oftentimes is somehow merge both left and right into the left context with some concatenation between the two. And of course, this is going to be awkward now because we are messing with the natural temporal ordering of sentences. And you could try to do this through supervised training as well, which will improve the performance, but it's never going to be quite right because there's this major gap between how pre-trained the trained and then how suddenly during supervision you're changing the natural order of sentences. Now, this is quite interesting question in the sense, as a human, we never really needed to train ourselves to read text in any different random order in order to be able to make edits when you write a paper or a proposal or article. As a human, we are able to jump around in a document and then make edits in the middle without necessarily training ourselves in that particular way. So there's something about the way that humans can learn to read only left to right. We never read in any other order, I believe. But we can still do this sort of reasoning. So maybe we can do this too through algorithms that are just the inference time algorithms. So we're going to achieve this through backpropagation, which is usually used for training neural networks. But in this image style transfer paper, they also use the backpropagation in order to change a photograph into something else that looks like it's a Gogh style image now. So in order to do that, you can define style loss, backpropagate that through the net, backpropagate the loss through the network all the way down to even the input image in order to mess with that input image. And then now this becomes the output image that's a result of a style transfer. So inspired by that, in this work, we're going to explore the use of the backpropagation for abductive reasoning. And our algorithm, DeLorean, so I'm going to give you the visual sketch of how this algorithm works, glossing over some technical details, but intuition goes something like this. So we do the usual business of left to right language model conditioning on the past and then generate the continuous representation of the desired sentence Y. Of course, this only reflects the past for now, but now that we have that, we can keep computing what the continuous representation of the future sentence Z might look like so that we can compute the loss function, which in this case is the conditional probability of the future sentence given the previous sentences. And once we have that, we can backprop in order to update the intermediate or continuous representation of the intermediate sentence Y so that it would improve the the loss function better. So we can do this iteratively because usually when you do backpropagation, you take iterations. So we do this forward, backward multiple times. Eventually, we can sample some concrete, discrete words out of this neural representation of a Y, which might become she hit the rope and the tire fell on top of her. So this was actual model output through this algorithm. Now, you might wonder, what do we do with the counterfactual reasoning case? So we do need to modify the loss function in this case, because the particular data set that we use called time travel allows to modify the third, fourth, fifth sentences with minimal edit. So in order to make minimal edit, we're now going to use KL divergence between the original story ending and then modify the story ending. So with that, I was almost shocked to see that off-the-shelf models can do this sort of reasoning. Apparently, GPT-2 already read about Games of Thrones during its pre-training. So it was able to do this. Super briefly about the evaluation. So based on human evaluation, because abductive reasoning is a hard task, that we don't yet have good automatic evaluation designed for. I think a human evaluation is really the one that's the most conclusive. And for this, DeLorean is doing better than supervised, best supervised method, which is not only based on supervised training, but also it's improved with COMET, Common Sense Knowledge Model, that I'm going to talk about later in the talk. But for now, let me highlight the fact that we have a lot to improve compared to human evaluation, I mean, human performance, which is much better. So this is sort of the point of this talk, which is that off-the-shelf neural language models can be improved by algorithms. So this is off-the-shelf. But that alone is not going to be sufficient in order to really, really close the gap compared to human performance. In terms of automatic evaluation, on the other hand, we do better than any other supervised baselines, but these automatic evaluations are not quite right. So these are blue and rouge and BERT score, which basically look at n-gram patterns of neurally generated text compared to the reference human written text. And because of the particular pattern in the data set, like language patterns, supervised method will better when it was exposed to learn n-gram patterns in the target data set. So, and also these n-grams do not really correctly measure whether the output text is actually coherent and plausible abductive reasoning or not. So this requires a further research in order to investigate. But in any case, let me share a little bit more examples. So here's another example where Ray drove his car on a steep mountain road, and then later he was fine, but his car was totaled. So our model generated that, well, he drove the car to the mountain, but his car is hit by another car. Here's another example, the model output of counterfactual reasoning. So this story is about Tara wanting to buy a new shirt for the upcoming school formal. And the original second sentence was that she went to the mall with her mom. And then here's original story ending, which is about shopping in the mall and trying maybe different, picking out a particular shirt and looking forward to wearing it. But this new counterfactual second sentence now is that they ordered from an online store instead. So the story, revised the story from our algorithm is now that they sent her a shirt, implying that it's the store, online store, sending her a shirt that she's excited to wear. So I think the results are quite promising for especially given that this is unsupervised methods. And let me share another different work called the neural logic, which aims to do controlled text generation with logical constraints. So the currently popular paradigm is sequence to sequence models that's supervised. And for dialogue response generation or machine translation or image captioning, there's input X and then output Y. Usually people concatenate this as a sequence and another sequence and then train sequence to sequence model. So this is pretty much the most popular recipe for conditional or controlled text generation today. Let me introduce you this common gen, which is a fun task where given a set of words, now your task is to say something reasonable, making use of all of these words provided to you. So this is really easy task for humans. You don't need even one example to be able to do this. You can just do it right away. But the fine-tuned optimized sig-to-sig models, even after trained on tens of thousands of examples, they don't really understand what they're supposed to be doing with input. I mean, that's reasonable how are they supposed to know that everything has to be incorporated? So they're learning something to make use of some words, but not all words are actually being incorporated. Another example would be machine translation case, in which the recent work has reported, I mean, this is a known fact, but they more formally quantified the fact that there's this gender bias. So neural networks really prefer to talk about men over women. So just change men, women into men. But as a human, if you happen to know German and German grammar rules, then you wouldn't make this kind of mistakes, because you just remember the rules and then you can incorporate. So the idea that we are exploring in this neurologic work is that perhaps there should be, there are limits in how much neural network can figure things out. Maybe we really need to find a way to incorporate logical constraints in a more algorithmic way. So logical constraints can be the natural way to incorporate some of the controlled text generation applications, like dialogue response generation, when maybe you want to make sure some informations are mentioned in your response, dialogue response. And then for writing a recipe, maybe you want to make oil-free chow mein recipe that make use of at least one proteins and one type of vegetables, but otherwise you don't care about the rest of the details. So this sort of logical constraints can be provided in the CNF form, conjunctive normal form, which is a combination of clauses. So we need to ensure that all the clauses are satisfied. And each clauses have multiple literals, and we can satisfy any of these literals inside the clauses. So such hard constraints can be made soft or softer by modifying the objective function that we typically use during decoding time, which is usually the conditional probability of output Y given input text X. But we could add another penalty term here, so that for any clauses that are not satisfied, we're going to pay for some penalty. And if you make this penalty really, really large, it almost becomes hard to constrain satisfy. So this is classical AI search problem. And I'm not going to go into the details here, but we do beam search where we improve the beam with diversity of clauses that are partially satisfied so far. In some sense, this is really, there's nothing completely novel here, other than the fact that just realizing that some of the classical stuff is good stuff for neural networks. So here's an example of supervised or fine-tuned language model, of course, making some mistakes, regardless of whether you do beam search or something newer, called the nucleus sampling. I'm not going to go into the detail, but this is what the text generation algorithms often use these days. But if you plug in neural logic decoding, then of course now it can make use of all the words better. By the way, the reason why CNF looks here is because we want to allow for words that are either plural or singular. This is due to the way that the data set task is defined. So write, rise, road, read, and any of this is okay. So this is naturally best provided as a CNF form. Now, what happens if we use unsupervised pre-trained language model as is? Of course, unsupervised models don't really understand what this set of words really mean, separated by commas. Doesn't make anything, so doesn't make any sense, so it's going to just ignore that and talk about something else. But what's quite exciting about neural logic is that it can still do really well, almost equally well, as it turns out. So let me show you the following set of graphs. So the coverage is the fraction of the time our method can satisfy the constraints. So also this neural logic, whether supervised or not, plugged, whether it's plugged into the supervised models or unsupervised models, it can almost always satisfy the constraints. The beam search on top of a supervised model. So this is what people will typically do with pre-trained language models. They train on the data set. Turns out they do learn something, especially when you use larger models. So the x-axis here shows the size of the models. And we know that usually the larger, the better with today's neural network performances. And this is very much true here as well. The larger, it's going to work better, but it's not really going to close the gap. So one might wonder whether we are achieving this by hurting the language quality. So Rouge and Meteor show the quality of generation, and it turns out that, so we perform better than supervised methods in terms of coverage, while also performing better in terms of language fluency and also relevance for the desired output. So what's also interesting is the fact that because the neural logic works so well, right after, even based on much smaller GPT-2, which is not usually as good as the larger models for generation, but because we do so well right off the bat, we actually do better even on smaller networks compared to supervised approaches based on larger networks. So in this new era when everything goes so big, so much so that GPT-3 is not anybody can really download to their machine anymore, maybe we could do much more compute efficient more compute efficient approaches based on algorithms. So here's another example is based on the recipe generation task, just in case you might wonder how well does it work. So we are about to finish the part one. To give you a bit of a big picture, the first one was a neural search. The second one was discrete search. So the discrete search is what's better known in the AI field for a while. But since we now have neural language models, we might need to develop inference time algorithms that are neural in nature as well. Here's something that's grayed out that probably I'm not going to talk about today, but I still wanted to mention it briefly because this one demonstrates yet another flavor of potential search algorithm that we could do called the reflective decoding. So this one briefly about unsupervised can be used for both the paraphrasing and abductive reasoning that we saw earlier. You might wonder what's the relevance between paraphrasing as a task and abductive reasoning, because these two tasks may seem quite different, but it's one algorithm that can do both. For for the purpose of paraphrasing and abductive reasoning, and what's different in this case compared to these previous two is that it's distributional, but over a sample of imagined context. So I would say this is a little bit somewhere in between these two, that it's discrete, but it's more distributional. And my speculation is that I found it hard to believe that I have already exhausted all possible inference time algorithms. And if people pay attention to this line of direction more, they might be able to develop much stronger algorithms than what I presented here today. So back to this current paradigm of deep learning that I mentioned briefly earlier. So this recipe fails on generative evaluation, such as abductive reasoning, counterfactual story revision, and a variety of constrained text generation tasks that require logical constraints. Here in this talk, I highlighted mostly common gen task, but in the paper, we talk about four different tasks. And the recurring theme that we notice is that the fact that this recipe works really well on today's leaderboards have a lot to do with the fact that leaderboards are multiple choice questions. When the problems are given in the multiple choice questions, it seems that neural networks can latch on spurious patterns in that exam style, just like humans also learn the exam crafting style of exam makers, and then we can sometimes do well on exam even if we don't know the material quite well. So similarly, neural networks are very good at that, but they don't really work well if the evaluation is set up as a generative evaluation, because it's harder to cheat. But what I want to discuss further is this something humans are able to do even? So imagine taking a deep learning class in which a professor doesn't teach anything but provides you with a lot of exam questions with the correct answers. I mean, we might learn something, but probably that's not the most efficient way of learning. And so as a result, in the field, a lot of people talk about the importance of unsupervised or self-supervised learning. And by and large, I agree with that direction too, but I don't think that's going to lift things all the way so that we could make a major breakthrough with everything in AI. Because imagine that as a human, instead of these multiple choice questions with the correct answers, now we are given with a lot of deep learning code, lots of it. If you happen to know Python, you might think, oh, I can learn that way, but actually no. What if the code was given in Korean language and it's not Python, it's something else, and you're given with a lot of code? I really don't think even humans can figure things out. Certainly we can't learn concepts well enough in this either way. And humans really prefer learning concepts through declarative knowledge, like tutorials or textbooks. So in the rest of the talk, I'm going to pitch this idea of maybe we should really think about declarative knowledge as a form of supervision for neural networks as well. So mostly I'm going to talk about COMET, common sense models, and as well as social chemistry, which will be about social, ethical, and moral norms. So we have a new COMET 2020, but this is actually building on our prior work, Atomic and COMET. So let me briefly introduce that to you. So first of all, Atomic is a symbolic knowledge graph for if-then reasoning. And it has so X repels Y's attack implies that maybe she wanted to protect other people or save themselves. Before then, she needed to train hard and know something about events because, I mean, I would probably run away. We can also reason about, so these were causes or preconditions. We can also reason about effect or post conditions. For example, her heart might race. She might want to file a police report. She might feel angry. He might fall back or might want to attack back and so forth. So emotional, bodily reactions, what actions they might take afterwards. Some of these are about dynamic state changes, whereas some of these are about static attributes, such as personality, being brave and strong, that do not change minute by minute. So we had this large network that we built. You might wonder, how should we get that knowledge? If we just try to learn from lots of text, there's this problem that neural network will think that we mother each other four times more often than we exhale due to the reporting bias. So for quality reasons, we decided to just ask people what they think. Important distinction between other resources, probably you heard about psych or many other knowledge bases, because if there are other stuff that already works, we didn't want to build our own. But there were two major differences that we wanted to address. So first of all, a lot of existing knowledge focused on knowledge of what. We wanted to complement that by focusing more on knowledge of why and knowledge of how, inferential knowledge on causes and effects. Really, one important decision we made was not to do things in logical forms. So this is one example that I took from Gordon and Hobbs 2017, and this is common sense inference rule. And I mean, I cannot really, even with coffee, I cannot really see this and then think that, oh, this makes a lot of common sense to me. Really, natural language is the natural way for humans to communicate and think. So we decided to go with natural language. I don't think we yet know how to translate natural language down to this sort of logical forms in a reliable way. There's a significant loss of information whenever we try to do that. So in doing so, we try to address these concerns about deep learning, not learning about causes and effects, but still using deep learning. So this is COMET Common Sense Transformers, which starts with the atomic knowledge graph. But the philosophical question here is this large enough or a little too tiny in this universe of knowledge that you and I share? So my speculation is that it's too tiny, but we don't need to store everything in some database. Similarly, how humans do not store everything in our head about, you know, if I ask you whether elephants are bigger than butterflies, you didn't need to store that before. You can just think about it and answer. But that's what we wanted to do. So common sense transformers begin with the pre-trained language models such as a GPT-2, but it's continued to, we train this on atomic knowledge graph that's serialized so that it has been trained on both the raw text as well as knowledge graph. So it's almost like teaching language models to read the textbook about how the world works in terms of a common sense. So there's an online demo that you can play with. It turns out COMET generalized much better than we expected at the time of our paper publication. So Sanya rides into the sunset on a motorcycle after solving AI. This is out of a domain distribution in the sense that atomic knowledge graph doesn't have people's name like Sanya. Also, the knowledge graph events are much simpler than this. It doesn't have anything about solving AI either. But the predictions are reasonable. It's focusing more on motorcycle right now, since it may not know what to do with solving AI, but it's now, she might need it to buy a motorcycle beforehand. She might be seen as someone daring and brave and adventurous. So Gary breaks the world record for most controversial tweet. So this is another very much out of domain example in that Atomic doesn't have anything about tweet or controversial tweet and doesn't know which Gary. But predictions are quite reasonable that maybe Gary wanted to be famous, might need it to write a book or magazine article beforehand. He might be seen as very famous. He might be happy as a result, might want to tell everyone about it. So Gary Marcus, as you probably know, because when he provided this context, what happens when you stick kindling and logs in a fireplace and then drop some matches is that you typically start A. And GPT-2 says complete nonsense afterwards, not understanding Gary's intent. So I countered him with this mosaic demo because if you type Gary stacks kindling and logs and drops some matches, our model is able to understand Gary's intent, even though, again, this is out of a domain distribution. I didn't expect that this would work in the demo, but it did. So this is really the power of the pre-trained language models that already knows a great deal about raw text. And then there's a transfer learning, effective transfer learning from this atomic knowledge graph. So the speculation here is that language models already have some implicit knowledge encoded, but that may not be enough. We need declarative knowledge. And by in doing so, it's good to use language as a symbol instead of logic, especially because that allows us to really combine language model with the declarative knowledge through this language as the representation medium. We need to focus more on causes and effects, and neural language, neural models are really the best for the purpose of generalization on compositional and previously unseen events. So finally, this new one, I'm not going to go into the details of the new graph other than just highlighting that now it has a lot more fun stuff as well, like money can be used for folding origamis or what sort of counterfactual situation can hinder an event to happen from happening. So you cannot really get your car repaired if your car is already totaled. So, per usual, we made this graph quite large. It has 1.3 million common sense if-then rules with 23 different types of common sense inferences. I'm going to just highlight one thing in terms of evaluation, because probably this question is what everybody's in everybody's mind these days, like how well does GPT-3 does? So let me first give you some like size differences. The Comet BART is more than 400 times smaller than GPT-3. This guy is too large. It cannot fit into the slide. It cannot fit into anybody's machine right now. With that in mind, I think GPT-3 is really impressive. Even with the few shot examples, it can already do so well. So this is based on the this is much stronger than how GPT-2 was able to do before, but still Comet BART is much smaller, and then still the performance gap is much larger, and this is really compute efficient. One might wonder, is crowdsourcing too expensive? But not really compared to how much expense you might need to spend in order to have a farm of GPU or TPU machines. So I would say this is really almost a dirt cheap compared to the cost of larger scale compute these days. So let me move to social chemistry now, which starts with this question about, again, how much does GPT-3 knows about morality? So here's a fun example. Running a blender at 5 a.m. might be rude because .. And GPT-3 says, because you can wake up the entire neighborhood. Wondering, what kind of blender is that? You can only do it if you are making a thick smoothie and need to incorporate some ice though. So it's a bit confused, but I guess no harm made by that. But how about if I say it is okay to post fake news if, and it says it's okay if it's in the interest of the people. So I thought, try again. And then it says something even worse. So I crossed out some acronym here. And so the problem with neural language models is that no matter how big it is, I don't think GPT-4, 5, 6, 7 will suddenly figure out true values that people believe in terms of ethics, moral norms. And the thing about social and moral norms really require full scope of language. This is another recurring theme in my talk. And in order to make my point clearer, let's look at an example. So asking my boyfriend to stop being friends with his ex. This is a situation, and depending on whom you ask, you get all sort of different rules of thumb. So some might say, oh, it's okay to ask your significant other to stop doing something that you are uncomfortable with. But someone else might say, oh, you cannot tell someone else what to do. So, and also depending on whom you ask, there's a narrator, there's a boyfriend, there's his ex. So lots of drama can happen depending on whom you ask. And it's really having a lot to do with what sort of values they focus more on, loyalty, care, or authority in this case. So for any given situation and the rule of thumb pair, in our work, we developed 12 different structural attributes, some of which are motivated by these moral foundation theories of Jonathan Haidt. It's done over 300,000 of rules of thumb, grounded on 100,000 different real life situations that people talk about. So once we have a lot of data, we can of course generate lots of tables with a lot of numbers, because that's sort of how we're supposed to be writing papers these days. But skipping all of that over, let me highlight two things. So first of all, communication really requires understanding people's norms. AI should understand people's norms as well. And that consists of some social norms, some moral norms, and some ethical norms. And it's not that easy to have a clean-cut distinction across these three. And I don't think it's that important. But more importantly, there's this question of who decides what's the right thing to do and where do you find them? And how do we make sure that AI can actually do use them? So for that reason, we decided to take inspirations from descriptive ethics, which is a line of research in ethics field that focus on asking people what they would do in a concrete situation. This contrasts with prescriptive ethics, which is more about what are five fundamental values or seven fundamental dimensions of morality that every human being must abide by. The problem with the prescriptive ethics, on the other hand, is that I don't think there's such a thing that every human being will agree with. You get different answers depending on, you know, people with the different religious backgrounds or cultural backgrounds or their personal beliefs, upbringings, and whatnot. And even if we somehow take a vote and agree on five values, I don't think that's immediately useful for AI because based on the sort of nuanced, complicated situations that people actually have to deal with, they cannot really figure out how to apply the five fundamental values down to some concrete situations. So it's really the best if the resource itself is grounded by design. Okay, so I'm now going to share some closing remarks. So when you search the word common sense from ACL Anthology, this is the repository of all the NLP papers. Most papers are either from 80s or from the past few years with a major gap in between. So when I was thinking about working on common sense, I was told not to do it. I was discouraged to work on it. In fact, someone told me not to even speak the word if I want to be taken seriously. But so I was taking that advice for some time, but then the more I thought about it, it seemed the past failures are inconclusive no matter how smart people have worked on because they didn't have access to computing power. They didn't have much data, no crowdsourcing available. Not as a strong computational models like transformers that we have today. And also they believed in logical forms a little too much and then had major struggle really expanding that to cover a lot of nuanced full scope of situations that you can describe only through natural language. So path to common sense, I don't know how to get there just yet. But one thing for sure, I don't think brute force larger networks will cut it because you don't reach to the moon by making the tallest building in the world taller 1 inch at a time. So in this work, I shared some of our initial efforts toward that goal. And there's also this common sense tutorial we gave for the first time this year, which to our big surprise was second most popular tutorial of all. And the tutorial covers a lot of different stuff that I didn't talk about today. But let me share my thoughts on language and embodiment because this is one of the commonly asked questions to me. So my dog has common sense without language, therefore AI doesn't need language for common sense. I think AI should really be ultimately for humans, not just for your dogs. Another commonly asked question is, well, some concepts like that juicy, crunchy feel you get when biting into an apple can't be learned without embodiment, therefore forget about language only. But the truth is, we never needed to see a tiger eating a human in order to believe that. We only learned it through language, I believe, because I don't think there's even YouTube video that actually shows you in your eyes. I think that would be unethical even. So like drowning in the ocean, we don't need to experience it. So we can learn a great deal about concepts in this embodied physical world, sometimes only through images, sometimes only through language. And so there may be these trade-offs between the coverage of concepts and the richness of experiences. And I think they provide different types of strength, and probably we need to do all of them, but language really has this unique benefit of providing a powerful representation medium to learn humans' embodied experiences through declarative knowledge. One more remark about language for human reasoning is that, this is not in computer science, the researchers in Kokusai wrote this really fast of the enigma of human reasoning, because humans are really strange beings when it comes to reasoning. So his argument is that reasons are usually, so system two reasoning are used primarily not to make an important decision. So guiding oneself here means making an important decision. For example, believing that language is important for common sense reasoning, I feel like I just had a hunch, first of all, based on intuitive reasoning. And then now that I want to justify my decision in the eyes of other people and convince other people, I'm really invoking system two reasoning. So system two reasoning really serves the purpose of communication, is his position or their position. And I thought this is really fascinating. The book also talks about how these two layers are sort of, it's not that disconnected, because system two builds on a great deal amount of intuitive reasoning as well, in which the clinical plays at best a marginal role. And this How We Reason by Philip Johnson Lair talks about this in a great detail as well. So finally, a bit of my story about how I got here. So I thought about what exactly I might share. I decided that I'll just be honest to say that, even I'm surprised by how long I, how much I arrived at today. But so I'm from South Korea. I fantasized about becoming a hacker. I never thought grad school is in my fate due to a variety of reasons. Practiced coding outside the classes a great deal, which helped me to come to US alone in 2000 to work as an engineer, even though I couldn't speak in English quite well. I had guests during the interview, but I could code. So I used to do very non-AI related stuff. I knew nothing about AI, but 3 years later, I discovered that, usually in CS, they provide RA and TA, so I can actually do it for free. I didn't need to worry about the cost. And I started fantasizing about AI, even though at that time, it was still corresponding to AI winter time. So a lot of people told me that it's not a good idea to do PhD, especially in AI. But just in case it might come back, I wanted to be ready for it. So in 2008, there was a subprime mortgage crisis. So the job market froze completely. In 2010, I managed to get just one interview and one offer to start my adventure at Stony Brook University. I was told not to do this and that. So many, I cannot believe how far I came despite all these moments when I was almost going to give up. Anyhow, I decided to assume that I'm not going to get a tenure, probably not, but just work on ideas that seem exciting. Per advice from Ray Mooney that I still thank so much, because that I think really helped me in some sense for other universities trying to recruit me as a result, which I never imagined to happen. So in 2017, I was very happy at UW. I mean, I was happy at Stony Brook too, but suddenly I wanted to start really working on common sense AI. I was really losing a lot of nights. I was waking up in the middle of the night thinking this must be a major, major mistake, but I just couldn't help. I think I was a very clear case of being blooming later in life, but in large part because I do have a lot of weaknesses, but also I cannot ignore the fact that there were implicit societal biases that didn't help very much. But the nice thing is that there were always some few really powerful encouragements that made the whole difference. So I really appreciate how NSF really emphasizes on education and research in support of diversity and equity. So wanted to brag a little bit about, I mean, this is really due to the amazing people around me who are very much dedicated to diversity as well. But so I didn't realize that this was happening for real, but suddenly I realized that half of the people at AI2, which includes a lot of you, the people, women. And so at some point we had 3 women postdocs and 2 undergraduate students. In fact, Shiming, who's the undergrad student, is the lead author of Neurologic that I presented today. And it seems that, I mean, probably the only thing that I did right were providing encouragements, but that seems to be the winning recipe for really supporting diversity in CS. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Yujin. So that was a great talk, an enormous amount of information. So our minds are reeling. So again, I'd like to ask people to type some questions into the Q&A. We have several from John Mallory, and I'd like to just begin with the first, which is also something that I was thinking about a lot. So the question is, what is the knowledge representation for natural language? Because at different parts of your talk, I was thinking there is no representation. It's just natural language. You imagine maybe it's just the strings, you know, just these sequences of words or sequences of word vectors. At other times we saw these graphical representations, and I guess at other times it's sort of implicit in your approach, in the whole deep learning approach, is that, well, what is inside really are just these enormous vectors, and perhaps there is some implicit representation in that vector space. So a word might have multiple meanings, but there is, in fact, there is some vector that really is associated with each, you know, particular true meaning, just like you might have a different predicate for each meaning. So could you reflect on that question?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. A question that I do think a lot about, but when we design things like atomic, really, in some sense, the choices of what sort of inference types, like as a result, somebody might want to do something, maybe one thing is capable of another. Like, who decides what exact 23 relations in our graph representation? To be honest, it's arbitrary. I mean, some people do complain that, shouldn't I derive this from some existing theories? But come on, there's no such a thing, as far as I know, that could really be used for building common sense knowledge graphs, I believe. But I mean, maybe that's a reason to think more about that as a research question, but in some sense, even if this is not complete and well thought out, still seems to be useful as a object that we can develop as a resource, which can then be used for training neural language models so that it knows a little more about how the world works than before. So it's going to know just as much as how much we teach, but in some sense, I'm just admitting the fact that I also don't know what's the right way of representing the knowledge, but I'm thinking more and more that this representation being natural language is a really factor in order to benefit from pre-trained language models. And having graph structure is a little bit more for humans than for neural networks, in that it's just nicer for humans to understand and modify and develop this. But what does help with the neural network is the inference types, because it does need to be able to reason about reason through different types of inferences. And so probably 23 is not enough. And I don't know how many we need to add more, but there's so much one can do over a year or two, but this is where things are. When we were working on social chemistry, that was so hard. So it's really the amazing co-authors, especially I should thank Max and Jenna for coming up with all this annotation schema, because I was really scratching my head thinking like, oh, these are so complicated and messy, in that you can convince yourself that, oh, I know how to define some of these categorical values with respect to one example. And then you see some other example, you realize that, I don't know, I want to go back and change something, but it was really difficult to come up with something that does work for everything. But in the end, probably what's more important is to allow for rich natural language descriptions here and there, so that it's not just categorical, but it's more in the form of a free text, at least for some of these annotations. So I don't know whether what we ended up doing is the way to go, but we wanted to give it a try with one version of what we might do with annotations, so that people might either find the flaws and try to improve or build up on this.
So it's just one clarification question there.
Yeah.
So if you predefined the, I said the links you were going to use, but since, given the size of this, this must have been automatically populated, this network. So how did you, what was the process for associating a particular link with, you know, the nodes on either side? Was that?
It's all crowdsourced. It was extremely expensive.
Oh, okay. So it was actually crowdsourced. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you would actually try to learn that. Okay.
I mean, we did. After crowdsourcing all of it, we started doing experiments by building neural models on top to see whether neural network can learn to reproduce correct labels for any of these 12 different types of attributes, or even be able to, like, given a situation, being able to generate rule of thumbs that might be more in this care dimension, or something, rule of thumbs that people might say that might emphasize more on the authority dimension. So citation is very rich, which means it can allow for different types of task formulations. And so maybe it's a bit too complicated right now, but that's what we happen to be doing in this work.
Okay. And I have another question from Maria Zemenkova. Who observed that your knowledge model included non-binary or fuzzy statements, such as something is an old car or it's too expensive, right? Where there's inherently sort of a relative soft nature. And she asked, what inference is used to yield the final, binary or fuzzy statement in natural language? Why does it come up with old car as opposed to just car or something more specific, like a 10-year-old car? Or how does the model create those kind of qualifiers?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. So during the annotation, I'm showing you here just a very tiny subset of what we actually annotate, but the way that annotation works is that we provide some event like this, and then define the inference type, and then ask many people to write what they think is plausibly possible as what goes into this node. So what it means is that all sorts of people imagine all sorts of different things about this event is underspecified. With additional context, many things can happen. So there's always some uncertainty. And what we found is the following. So although we don't know whether, she's repelling Y's attack because wants to protect herself or themselves or protect other people, At least we know that somewhere in this space, as opposed to she did it because she wanted to go to bed or she wanted to write an essay paper. That's just a little too far. So we found that distributionally, even if some of these don't really agree with each other, it actually doesn't matter for the purpose of training neural network on top. Just like how it's okay to train language models on natural language corpora, where you know the task is to know which word comes next. Who knows which word comes next? I mean, in some cases, there's only one word that can come next, but in many other cases, there are multiple different words that could come next. And we may not know for sure which is better word to come next, but when we do this in a very large scale, a distribution arises such that sometimes it's a very skewed distribution, sometimes it's a flat distribution. Even if it's a flat, there are certain things that are more reasonable than the other. And so learning this distribution is the key for language modeling. And I'm beginning to think that exactly the same is true for knowledge modeling as well. We do need to learn distribution of knowledge. And if the event was not specified and allows for a lot of different imagination, that's what Turkers do. And that's what neural network learns as well as a result. So I don't think in the annotation, people tend to write things like a 10-year-old car versus 11-year-old car. They just tend to say simply old car. So that's what neural network ends up learning. That's how it's done.
Okay, thanks. I have a question from one of our program directors, Armada Shehu. So the examples show that the success in coming up with these abductive or counterfactual statements seems to be on par with what a middle school child can achieve. They are reasonable but somewhat perfunctory. For example, she hit the rope and the tire fell on her. An adult would perhaps have gone further. The father did not secure the tire well, and the child fell when trying it out. So what do you think is missing in order to I guess, come up with, more richer type answers?
Absolutely. So that really, I totally agree with that viewpoint. So although I have shown you better examples, of course, when we look at this human evaluation, I did highlight the fact that if a human evaluate on human written text, it's really far better than what our algorithm is able to do. So there's a gap. And probably to some degree, if we used the GPT-3 instead of GPT-2, performance might have improved some. But it's likely that there's this significant gap. And I think the fundamental issue right now is the fact that pre-trained language models at the end of the day are all trained through this recipe where the task is about given bunch of words, what word is missing in the middle. And I don't know like how this is the right way of learning about the true concept on how the world works. For reasons similar, humans cannot just read a lot of raw text. Even as a baby, like if imagine like a baby not provided with any textbook, not taking any classes. I mean, really, but in the case of babies, they still learn from their caregivers through declarative language because they ask, what is this? They ask a lot of why questions, why someone is doing what they're doing. And then the caregivers do say a lot of things in such weird declarative language that probably they wouldn't speak to another adult in their day-to-day lives. So I'm thinking that using this current paradigm, there's so much we can do, and we might really need to teach the concepts to machines through some form of declarative knowledge so that neural network can also learn from textbooks or tutorials. And in this talk, I presented some efforts into that direction, but it's still unclear to me whether COMET is covering enough of that abductive reasoning to match human level performance. COMET does help, by the way. We know that at least it helps over even supervised method, which is usually hard to boost, but there's still a lot of reasoning that's missing.
So the examples you gave in the talk were all literal uses of language. And back to one of John Mallory's question, he asked about how metaphors involving type inconsistency, how are they represented? And maybe I'll even broaden that out in thinking that one of the books that I love to return to that I'm sure you're well familiar with is Metaphors We Live By, that argues that, you know, metaphor is not just an epiphenomena, but it's the actual core of language. And could you give some thoughts about that?
Absolutely. So when I was giving a talk on Atomic at Northwestern, someone gave me adversarial example to try, which was X repels Y's attack in a chess game. So my immediate reaction was that, oh, it's not going to work because that's a little too different. And so I searched the atomic knowledge graph. It doesn't have anything about repelling one's attack. I mean, even with the paraphrasing, you don't have that kind of situation covered in Atomic. But to my huge surprise, if you try this online demo, then you get everything about winning the chess game or being like a competitive, suddenly like all these predictions changes into more intellectual capacity. By the way, the new website, it doesn't look like this. It has, you need to click on, I think, events, Atomic, for that kind of stuff. It now has a lot of different stuff under. So I think what's happening is that because of the reason, like, so I really like this metaphor we live by as well, because I realize how people use a metaphor all the time. And what it means is that as a result, natural language reflects a lot of it. I don't think a neural network knows whether something is a metaphor or not, but because there's just a lot of patterns in which language is used both in metaphoric and non-metaphoric literal meanings, neural network ends up picking up on that and then speaking metaphoric language, probably not realizing that it's doing metaphor, but it seems that, so if you give a little bit more metaphoric examples, it tends to speak in that metaphoric space as well.
Sorry, I was just actually going to the AI2 site to see if I could find the link. I didn't find it, but maybe you can type that into the chat. So those of us who would like to find the link to the demo, or just send to me, we'll send it around.
Link should work, I think. Did I misspell?
Oh, the link is still the correct one. Okay.
Oh yeah, okay. It's correct. It's correct. It's just that when you land there, it's not look exactly the same because we changed the UI design a little bit, but it's there for sure. And then on tap on the left-hand side, that there are multiple options to choose from. And if I remember right, you need to choose something that's about events because Atomic and Comet so Atomic represents event knowledge, ConceptNet represents more object knowledge. And there's also Visual Comet demo.
I see. Okay, great.
Too many choices to choose from, but because our Comet can be used on top of ConceptNet as well, so it provides that demo too.
Okay, and so let me have one more question. You mentioned how you found it a little scary to work in this area because, as you noted, it's an area where it got a lot of work in the 70s and 80s and then disappeared and has only recently become reputable again. And it seems actually in kind of the extreme times we live in, it's now like the hottest thing has gone from common sense reasoning has been gone from, you know, complete being reputable to, it's great. It can do everything. You know, we can do some nice toy examples. We can, we're not exactly running the you know, our whole education system on automated common sense reasoning yet. So some of these things, you know, again, certainly do remind me of work on frames and MOPS and Shank and Walensky and all that kind of work. And I wonder if you have any reflections on both what you found as an inspiration in some of this older work, but what the current approach by you and similar people, why it's going to work this time, what's different?
Great question. So yeah, I really appreciate this question because it's not like on one day, suddenly out of a sudden, I started thinking about common sense. I think although I see her explicitly in 2017, I think it really hit me hard in 2013 or so when there was Chuck Fillmore tribute workshop. I don't know whether it was Knuckle or YMNLP, but I think it was 2013 or 14 when I accidentally entered into that workshop in which there were talks given by Ken Church and it was organized by Miriam Petrock and other collaborators. And in which I learned about Case for Case that Chuck Fillmore wrote and some examples in that original work about frame semantics. And I realized that, oh, this is like way more than how I understood about the frame semantics as just a semantic role. It had a little bit much narrower misunderstanding about frame semantics as it's some kind of parsing business. But I realized that at least in this original vision that he had, it was really encompassing some of these common sense expectations about how the world works. You know, like one example that I remember is you usually save something valuable. You don't save garbage. You try to save maybe whales because they're natural beings that are precious. And I realized that that's really part of common sense knowledge. But I didn't yet know what to do with that sort of insights that I learned from that workshop. But it was sort of like haunting me from time to time. And I started writing some papers that tried to look at this pragmatic aspect of frames as opposed to aspects of the frames. And I think it took me some time to courage up, I guess. So why this might be different this time? I mean, to be honest, who knows? I feel like at least this Mosaic, the Comet online system is much better than anything we've seen before in terms of the capabilities of being able to reason about previously unseen events. But to be really honest, when I was making Comet, I really didn't think that it can handle examples like this. I really didn't. So I got somewhat lucky, I admit. But the reason why it might work is because we now have a deep learning. We now have a crowdsourcing. We have a lot more data and compute. But I still don't know how far this might reach. But I'm hoping that some other smarter people will figure something out.
Great. Okay, well, I think we'll give people just 5 minutes to get onto ready for their next Zoom call. But those of us at NSF are welcome to join the office hour, the NSF office hour at 3 p.m. Eastern time today. So 3 p.m. Eastern, that's 12 noon on Pacific time. So we can't give you a round of applause. I can wave my hands. We should tell the AV tech team here is we need to get some pre-recorded applause. Well, I'll just have to get that ready for next time. But it's been a fascinating talk and look forward to meeting with you in a small group this afternoon. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you so much. See you later.